two ways. And it was a preview for me for moderating a panel at a Civil Rights Division 50th reunion in Washington over the weekend, at which in some way the story of civil rights was told in a way that was very immediate to the idea of law and law enforcement. It was the story that continued on from Cooper and Aaron and troops in Little Rock to the Voting Rights Act. And so we had John Doerr, who was the real leader of the movement, at least in the field, on the panel, and John Siegenthaler, who was the editor of the Tennessean, which was a crusading newspaper, and very close friend of Bobby Kennedy, and advisor to Bobby Kennedy when he was just becoming Attorney General and choosing the leadership in the Civil Rights Division. And a guy named Chuck McDew, who was the chairman of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was the people's wing of the legal strategy that led to the Voting Rights Act. The idea was SNCC was just an extraordinary group led by Bob Moses and Chuck McDew, who were organizing voter registration drives in the most rural parts of the South, basically Mississippi, and doing so under tremendous conditions of threat and arrest. They're, you're really up against a system that is in place deep, deep into the structure of the Southern society in the wake of Reconstruction. It's like the South reconstituted itself in a culture, a consciousness that infused the police, the governorship, the states, the judges. And so the story of how law was used and this little team of lawyers basically working with this team of kids who were willing to be brave was wonderful and an example in its way. Well, it's just got argument in it. It's got algorithm in it. It's a story of I think a brilliant legal strategy executed by a brilliant legal team that has elegance in it, because it really successfully succeeded in educating, using the law to educate first the federal judges, first the lawyers who went out in the field and actually investigated and saw for themselves, and then incorporated what they saw in a legal strategy that they put before a judge, and then played out in rhetorical theater using the documents of the law, interrogatories and witnesses, and essentially educating a judiciary to it, which then educates a Congress to it, which along the way educates a whole lot of people that were very glad to see the paradigm shift. So if you accept the idea of the possibility of seeing it differently, you're suddenly in an alternate space. It's like a virtual space. It's like you don't have to give up your grip on what you think is real, But you're thinking about it as if it was the other way, enough to actually see it and feel it and credit it and get the force of it. And here comes Second Life, where the first thing you have to do is choose your identity. So what we're going to do today is focus on choosing your identity. I want each one to have an avatar. How many of you have avatars already? So somehow, I want those who have avatars, along with Ken and Becca here, to help those who don't to get one right now, so that we're all in the space together. Who doesn't have one yet? So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So, can we turn around and somehow help to get an avatar? Who's going to help over here? We got some lame people over here. Ken, help. Just do it, yep.
Everybody
tutor everybody else.
Okay.
Who's missing? Who hasn't got the coaching they need?
I think I got to figure out. I'm just going to install it.
Okay, Patrick.
I think I have an avatar. The problem is every time I try to use Second Life, my computer crashes. So I'm sort of.
Come down here and see if you can sign on to mine. So, the people who have avatars already and who are just sitting there twiddling your thumbs, would you get into Second Life and get together down in the amphitheater outside Ames on Berkman Island? Can you do that?
There's a new version of Second Life.
Did you just teleport?
That's back now.
Do you have flexi here?
Just teleport.
They did?
Noriega? Should I do Noriega? Yeah. Make it
make it real. What's
Watts? There's only one availability. So you can't be the same name as someone else?
Right.
Well, then they should make them all last names.
They only let a few hundred people get each last name.
I hated that. They force you to take a name.
I find it interesting. I'm not sure how I feel about
yeah,
it.
No,
but then you have kinship with the other people
yeah,
who share your name.
You're creating other worlds.
Yeah. Huh?
It's like in...
Can you still sign up for Berkman? Is Berkman an available last name still?
Berkman was never an available last name.
It was never available.
No, it's a privately owned name.
Oh.
You can own
we actually
you can
own the name.
I don't think they'll put Berkman into their last
Jackson.
At whose direction? Berkman's direction. So somebody controls that? But I mean, who would care whether we had Berkman last names?
We gotta use a real email.
Whoever decided that should be the last name
for
people on
that. But that's what I'm saying, it's only a limited number of Berkmans.
That's
true. Right, so we could somehow make Berkman available to me?
No, we can only do that on a case-by-case basis. Catherine, we control.
Someone's already chosen Jackson Noriega. That is ridiculous.
I don't want to join anymore.
You got to find the show.
I don't want to join anymore.
Can you kill people?
I want Jackson Noriega.
Who is Jackson Noriega?
That's such a good name.
We don't know. That's what we're trying to figure out.
That's just my name.
I mean, that's somebody with an excellent name.
Be also Jackson.
Maybe Noriega. Someone's in the landing space.
God, that was such a good name.
Is it even possible to fly there? No. I think I might be on a hill. Let me log on to my island. Maybe I can offer you a teleport there.
Berkman Island isn't currently available, actually.
I don't know.
You need somewhere else.
Fred Friendly's rule once again.
I can get there. It's like 38,000 meters away.
This might take a while.
It's,
actually.
Yeah, flying at like
what's
with
this?
This
is important.
You can't fly there. That's not actually physically possible.
Can you change
it?
Names?
It's showing it to you on the map. You like an arrow on how to get there.
No, I
don't want
to do that.
But you'll find that you just
you're right.
Are stuck flying nowhere.
Yeah, I just ran
it. It's easier to change your name.
Really?
Got
me pulling the count.
Interesting. Just go back to the courthouse.
How more you get?
You don't have to pay for it. That sounds pretty.
John Carlo.
Yeah, that's good.
Am I up on the screen?
Maybe it's
Alex. J-E-A-N. John. G-I-A-N. That's a little bit too great. Just teleporting for your recording. John Laser. I did like that. I was using that. John Paul
Murray.
Can
I have a free play? No. You need to click on the box of the items that are on the line. And it's going to say, take this or pay $30 for this.
John Jackson Noriega. That is a good name. Yes.
That's the name. But that's taken.
I'm showing on the computer. That's taken. Can it only be one name? Can I have a middle name?
Hyphenated?
Oh, I have to hyphenate it?
I don't know.
I don't want it to be hyphenated. I want two first names.
I don't know what my name was.
It won't let me do it. I can't have two first names, even if it's hyphenated.
I'm going to go back to my computer.
No, just letters only.
Just to stick them together and capitalize the second one.
One word, I guess. It doesn't look so lit, but.
I don't like talking to you because when I tried to be friends with somebody last time I was in Second Life, they said they didn't want to be my friend.
It's because you just friended someone that you've never even communicated with. That was Joe Rogan that brought. Did you try to friend?
That's my thought.
Is it you?
No.
Way next door.
No, thank you.
You just pick things up.
Club mail. No,
thank you.
Yeah.
Furry. Is there more than just these like 10 choices or 12 choices? Or
once you get inside, you can be anything. It,
That's just what you start out with.
Oh, they need to use animation.
Where's like football play?
This program looks like it's gigantic.
You're going with furry.
I might, if I can totally customize.
I'm trapped in home.
That's your swashbuckler size.
This is gonna work. So where is everybody in terms of having an avatar? Are there people that still don't have one?
I'm in the process.
In the process.
I have one, but I can't log in.
Yeah, it's taking a long time to log in.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We're not rolling restart.
So we're suffering various forms of technological impediment.
It's because the birth rate is down.
This keeps up, I'm going to have to actually interact with people in the real world. We can't have that.
All right. Well, I think that is the challenge. So, I tell you what. Suppose we do something totally radical. Totally radical. Close the computers.
Can I just turn mine around? Still installing.
Close it. You can't put it to sleep. In other words, I have to look at it. That's okay.
Well, just put it in the corner.
No, you can turn it around.
Should I close it
to
you if I'm not done?
Oh.
I'm still in the process of creating.
In the process.
Yeah, it hasn't even installed yet. I couldn't choose the name fast enough, I guess.
All right. Leave it open. I don't want to touch more.
Who would think Jackson?
John Jackson.
Would be Tate.
Yeah, Jackson. Right.
But that's what I want to talk about. But we're talking about choosing an avatar, which is choosing an identity. You're actually able to make a conscious choice about your identity. You're really into the name.
It's important.
Why?
That's the first thing when you meet someone, what do you say? Well, besides looks, but what do you say? It's, my name is Jad, or my name is John Jackson. Noriega.
You had a pretty badass name to begin with, and somehow you managed to just raise it. John Jackson.
John Jackson. It's a powerful name, man.
So what is this? The very first thing that we list on the score of importance, the name, which is so important.
Well, I mean, looking cool would be important, too, but I haven't got there yet.
Haven't got there yet. Right. And look at us. There's not a single one of us in here. Oh, maybe I'm wrong. That chose our own name. Am I right?
I chose my own first name.
Sarah is rad.
Actually, I think there's probably three or four or five people in here who chose their own names.
Really?
At least their own names.
Well, I'm sure that you're probably right, but I just relate to it as a captive of my own experience. You know, I'm Charles Nesson. I'm Charles Rothwell Nesson. That's the name. My mother and father put on me. And I accepted it. It was written down in law. And I never changed it. So to me, at any rate, it's just a reminder that at least some of us
start our rhetorical lives in a form of bondage.
Well, all of us do if you consider our looks as well.
Yeah, what about looks? What about race?
They have those new shows where you can get plastic surgery kind of on, you know, on TV. Extreme Makeover, was it? Some like Extreme Makeover.
The best one's the MTV one where you can look like a celebrity and have people who like want to look like Britney Spears and like give them plastic surgery until they look like. Oh, this is like Britney Spears 10 years ago because nobody wants to look like Britney Spears. Yeah. Right now.
All that work and I can't run Second Life on my computer.
Why? It just isn't.
It just is air.
Why does it say so?
It's
not.
You up there. I tried the
memory. Yeah, mine says Second Life is unavailable.
The mine says my video card isn't supported.
Hmm.
Oh,
shit.
That could be bad. What?
College.
The year.
Hmm.
Doesn't like me.
Well, I'm eager to have you have the experience of choosing your avatar.
Mine would look just like me.
That's the...
Except they probably have a cool design in their hair, which I can't do because I have OCI.
Well,
might have bigger arms or something.
Yeah, I wish I could show you my avatar, but I can't get it up. It looks just like me.
I love the trailer you have for this class.
Huh?
Where you're wearing the same outfit as him, and you just switch between the two of them.
Yeah.
It looks exactly like you.
That was the idea. But in some ways, it's the most conservative choice. It's like the one you take the least chance with. It's like you don't express your inner identity by choosing an outer lookalike. So I feel a little constrained myself, not only in name, but expression, from having, in some way, chosen too fast. But I understand it's mutable. I can change myself. How many of you chose non-human avatars?
Most people aren't even in Second Life.
So here's what I want to talk about. What's your avatar? What's your avatar? What's your inner identity that you can express in a virtual space, where you start without the constraints of age or race or... Well, what do you think the constraints are? What are the constraints? What would they be?
Real life or Second Life?
Second Life.
Well, for the purposes of this class, I chose an avatar with my name that looks like basically like me. But only because I think because it's for this class, and then everyone else knows, you know, I think it's just easier to identify the person online if they look like, and they have the same name as somebody in this class. But I think if I was doing this outside, I would have probably done something different.
Oh, but that makes a lot of sense. That's got a nice community spirit to it. Justifies our choices. The look-alike choice.
I kind of did the same thing Jahad was saying you would do. I kind of made myself to look the way that I would look if I didn't have to go to OCI to introduce. So. Just little changes. Also, there's some more tattoos, but it's only because I'm a joke.
I want to disagree with the premise of your question, though, that the avatar as being an expression of something inner that we're expressing our true self in this media, because I chose my avatar more as a mask in order to
play the game in a certain way and have certain types of interactions with people online.
See, that's kind of funny because I did the opposite where I kind of feel like this is a bit of a mask and what I created online was kind of more closer to myself. So it's kind of interesting.
The idea of mask is tremendously interesting. It links up totally with poker.
So I almost feel like the avatar that looks like you is almost more invasive. Like, I feel like on Facebook and some of these other social networking things, some people I know are reluctant to put the images of themselves up because they feel like it's kind of, it's private. They don't, mm-hmm. they want to have a mask. And other people, I guess, I'm trying to kind of like put my online image, at least have my online image be somewhat similar to my offline image so I don't get confused, you know, so I don't have some mask in the online world where, and then have my offline world and forget which one's which.
You're really worried about that.
Yeah, I am. Well, it's part of this larger goal of trying to live with integrity generally and stuff like that, but no, I think it is, like, I don't know.
But wait. The idea of living integrity, I think that's great. But don't get me wrong, I'm all for it. But integrity in real space means coherence in real space. But it doesn't mean that you have to live the same in your fantasy space as you live in your real space. That would be really boring.
Yeah, I guess I just don't see the online space as being fantasy anymore. It's part of life.
I seem to have this idea that people are going to have one avatar.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, seems sort of unnatural to me.
Uh-huh. To have one or to have multiple?
To have just one. I mean, you might have one in one world and one in another world. You might have multiple in the same world, but they could be used to express different parts of your identity or different masks of just different views that you want to present.
Second life gives you always the chance as well to have like a completely neutral. Say if you just take the one you're given at the start, so you don't do anything to it. So there's something which no one gets anything from whatsoever, apart from your decision that you didn't want to have anything to look like anything. And so your interaction with people then based purely on your actions or on your what you type, your words in the world, which then has kind of interesting meaning. It just makes it hard to interact with people who are in the game, because they might think you're new, so they don't want to interact with you. But if you played a part of it in this kind of completely neutral kind of space, it's an interesting kind of mask, because it doesn't give anything away. And I wonder how people would react to that.
It's interesting, from the little I know, and I'm just a novice in this, but the chance meeting in the space of one avatar to another, so you're suddenly in a chat space, and after all, you came there to experiment with communication in a sense. So you speak, and the avatars itself, like the name, it's like the first thing that you see. It's like the first stimulus to the other person. And I think that you could easily see the idea of going there to observe and listen and not being all that interested in talking endlessly about your avatar and taking a very neutral stance. But I could also see going in with something that's really got a lot of style and action and says, hey, come talk to me. That's what I came here for. It's like, yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, I find that idea, the idea of being a neutral avatar, much more attractive. I mean, when I was designing my avatar, I was designing it or attempting to design it to look as much like me. I haven't really figured out how to make it look like me yet. But that and the name and everything was meant to just sort of reflect me, because I mean, I don't see any value in giving away information about how I would choose to look in a virtual world or anything like that. I mean, I designed my virtual world to look like me because this is the way I look. So this is the amount of information I'm used to giving off naturally. Then in an online world, I don't see any advantage to necessarily like giving away information until I have some sort of position where that's advantageous to me.
What do you think, Ken? You're giving away information.
That's absolutely the case. You're just sending out symbols
in this virtual space. And that's why I think you might be missing out on something if your avatar resembles your real life, the set of symbols that you're sending out in real life, then people will respond to you similarly to how they respond to you in real life. Whereas if it's radically different, you'll be treated very different. And I learned things about the way like different groups of people operate because I chose a female avatar. And the look of this avatar is not something that I specifically chose, but through people that I met in Second Life, a group of strippers, actually, who were women who were, or men or whatever they were, their avatars were women who were strippers. And I was talking with them and they were criticizing my look and whatnot. So I said, well then take me shopping. And so we went out there and they were putting different clothes on me, putting different bodies on me, putting different hair on me, criticizing me, saying my choices were wrong, no, you can't look like that. And through this group of like, this process of half a dozen people, it developed into the look that I now have. And I just remember how I felt as...
Did you stripper eye for the virtual guy?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And I realized that this might be a whole thing that women in real life are doing to each other. And it was sort of like a construction of conformity, and it was sort of... it was like my choices were being criticized, so it was sort of making me vulnerable, and there was pressure to conform with this group identity. It was very interesting. So I saw an insight into things that are happening in real life that I haven't been part of because of the body that I was born into.
Your avatar.
Yes.
How similar did the strippers look to each other? Were they all like kind of similar, or did they just kind of...
They all shop at the same places, pretty much.
You'll find that's true in the real world as well.
One thing that was interesting is that that if you look the same as you do in real life, you're sending the same symbols. I found that to really not be true.
Really?
In Second Life, because everybody in there is capable of looking like a super hot stripper girl. And so most of the women you meet in there do look like a super hot stripper girl. That also seems to be what most of the clothing on sale is. Up until fairly recently, if you wanted to look like a professor or something like that, and especially a male professor, you'd have an extremely hard time finding the clothing and getting yourself to actually look that way. So if your avatar is realistic, and, you know, truly depicts yourself with your arms the size that your arms are, if you're a guy, you look kind of weird to people. It's like, why did that guy choose to be this scrawny dude when he could have had this big, muscle physique? I have no comment on your specific arms. But it does have a different meaning to replicate real life looks in a world where you don't have to look that way at all.
All right, so get this. Just in terms of like a project. Beckett and I are down at the business school this afternoon talking to a committee of faculty and administrators about the business school's interest in Second Life. Now that's a pretty interesting thing in itself, that the Harvard Business School is seriously looking at this environment. That was like the first piece of it. But the second piece of it was, the thing that came out of the meeting was the need for a pathway that would lead incoming academics, like professors, down a path to let them easily shop and buy and do their stuff so that they could. And one of the professors who was there said, all right, now there's an entrepreneurial project. We could actually have a student undertake the project of going into Second Life and opening that store and running it at a profit. And they all liked that as a kind of integrated project that would
get them into the environment, ease their way into the environment, give their students something to do, and, you know, good project.
Does Second Life have a tutorial that I missed?
The first thing that happens when you get in there is you should arrive at a place called Orientation Island.
Yeah, it does.
Has a four-part tutorial that teaches you all the basic stuff, and then from there it tries to take you to a place called Help Island or a variety of other places that are geared towards people who are new to the world. So one of the things that's troublesome about this get an avatar and get right to Burton Island is you have everybody skip that part of it. And it also gives a very bumpy first introduction to something that can go more smoothly if you have more steps and advanced preparation about how hard it's going to be on your computer and things like that. But they're trying pretty hard, and what they've done, I'd say, is about 50% adequate for your average computer user in terms of getting in there and feeling comfortable. It's still a pretty steep learning curve for people when they get there the first time.
They don't have like a bot or anything that'll walk you through it?
The Orientation Island is like that. You arrive there and there's like little on-screen tutorials that says, go do this.
I'm thinking like a robotic controlled avatar, like a LinkedIn Labs bot avatar that would come there and be your first friend and like walk around with you or something.
It wouldn't do anything different than what this tutorial already does for you. It's not really easily built in to Second Life to have bots of that sort, which is perhaps on purpose, but they just, because it would be pretty fun to create them, but it's a pretty challenging thing to do, actually.
Yes, it's true. On the other hand, I was hoping that we could have something up on the screen that would kind of give us the focal point for discussion. The thing that, to me, is interesting about these worlds is that you need something to draw you into them. It's true, getting into them can be a rough ride, but really it's more a question in the long run about having stuff in there that you want to get to than it is how smooth the ride in is. But yes, Becca's certainly right about it. Hi.
Hi, sorry.
We've been talking about identity.
Want to be here?
Sure.
So, worth considering how identity relates to character and how both relate to argument.
When you say character in that sentence, in what sense?
In the sense, in rhetorical terms, in the sense of charisma. Somehow, that form of impact of the speaker that comes from the ineffable, but you see it and you feel it. You can't exactly identify what it is. It's like it's a third of the message. That's the character part.
There's a television show called The Pickup Artist. It's a kind of silly premise. The idea is like these guys are really nerdy and they try to learn how to pick up women. And they go into bars and there's a guy who teaches them how to do it. So the first thing they do, they call it creating an avatar, and they kind of change the way they dress, they change their hair, they shave, they kind of create this image how they want to be presented when they're going out to do pickup. And it's interesting, the last episode of the show, these really kind of nerdy guys, and they only have 6 hours to practice, and then all of a sudden they're transformed, and they're able to now interact with women in a positive way. And a lot of it was just the image. It was just like, change your hair, put on different clothes, and the message was totally different. It was kind of a weird setting. It was similar to what you're talking about.
It's similar to what Ken was saying. Like, it put through some weird conformity process that indicates that looking like you just walked out of Banana Republic is good, and then it's like a mask that you can wear to go act like something other than yourself.
Yeah.
But that's your question about identity. It's like we know what identity is, but do you mean by identity how you physically present and what your name is? I mean, identity is not so easy to...
Well, that's just the beginning of it, that's for sure. Yes?
Actually, my mom's part of a... It's kind of a cult. But it's called Avatar. And it's more like a self-help course that's really expensive. But the whole process, she made me do the whole thing. And the whole process is like... they talk about identity, and every time I'm like, I'm sad, she's like, that's your identity. And the idea is like, if you want...
Say that again?
She said, if I'm like, oh, I'm sad, or like, I'm not doing well in school, she's like, that's your identity right now. And like, the whole idea is to become this, like, so let's say you want to be a rich person, and they kind of teach you, like, you have to, that has to be your identity, you have to become this rich person. If you think that your identity is I'm a rich person, then you will be one, or something. So I tried that with smoking, and then I was like, I'm a non-smoker, and then I became one. But now I'm smoking again, so I don't know how far it goes. but I don't know if that kind of, I don't know, if that idea of identity is sort of kind of relevant.
Hmm. Yes,
you seem to be talking about identity as this conception of what you would be in the absence of constraints. So you're talking about Second Life, because it has fewer constraints on your physical size or, you know, your clothing or whatever, that presents this opportunity for you to be more like yourself, whatever that means. But this seems to me a strange notion. I mean, I grow up, I become who I am through a variety of constraints, and yet when I come out of this process, sometimes I feel like there are things I would change, and sometimes there are things that I wouldn't change, even if I could do it all over again. So it seems to me strange that this default notion of who we would be without constraints would actually produce this identity. Wouldn't it produce more likely just nothing? Like it seems to me that identity has to be shaped by certain principles or certain ideals, otherwise it's not what we would conceive of ordinarily as identity. It has to be chosen in some sense. But there have to be principles of choice to begin with, and that's, you know, a recursive problem, but that gets back to the notion of constraints in the real world. Why is it inappropriate?
I think that it's what I agree, I guess, as a descriptive matter with what you say, but I'm not sure I can get to the conclusion that makes Second Life radically different from real life. Because I think the constraints we have in real life are largely self-imposed, just as the constraints we have in Second Life are.
Okay, but even if you go from that premise, the notion seems to be, at least in this room, to that take on a different avatar in Second Life, that you could potentially choose one that's more expressive of your real identity or whatever that means. And if you're right, that doesn't seem to make sense.
So you're basically making just an anti-essentialist argument. We don't all have some essential identity separate from the way that we interact with our choices and the constraints around us.
I'm not sure I'd go that far. I think you could have an essential self. I'm just not so sure that what you are now is not that.
Say that last again. What you are now is not that.
Is not your essential self, your identity.
What you are now is not your essential self.
I'm not sure that that's... I think it's possible for you to create an avatar that looks like you, that acts like you, that is you in a very essential way. And I think that for a lot of people, that's not a bad thing.
But it's not like Second Life is less constrained. In truth, it's probably more constrained because you can choose different body types and clothes, but you lose a lot of things like tone of voice and posture and body language and all these eye contact and all these other signaling things that we have in real life.
Sure.
So you're just trading one set of constraints for another.
Those constraints could produce a different outcome.
I don't know your name, but something you said makes sort of connects up to what you were saying about the identity and character for the purpose of making an argument. You were saying that your law school or your OCI self is like a mask. And your real self, you know, how you are with your friends and when you're at home would be something different. And it seems to me like that, you know, neither of those are really less you. They're both you doing the different things. It's just that you get into a specific situation, you have a particular argument to make or a place to be or a set of people to interact with, and you show yourself in a way that is strategic. It's not necessarily a mask, it's just it's a version. One of, I don't know, just it seems so weird to make identity be this like thing that exists in one way. It doesn't change depending on the situation you're in.
Yeah. See,
I think it's a shame that we have to do that, because my ideas that I have don't change with the mask that I put on, just the way that people see the person kind of throwing the ideas out there. And I think it's extremely unfortunate that society has to be that way.
But maybe that's just a question of communication. I mean, everybody's coming from a different point, so you've gotta figure out how to express yourself in a way that will help you to be heard by the person that you're speaking to, and it may involve different form of presentation.
I agree with that, but I think there's certain things that, even just physical things, that are hard to overcome from certain situations. Like, and this is kind of like a small superficial example, but I mean, the difference between me right now and me when I flip that up and my nose piercing is invisible, that with the like seriousness I get taken with is extremely different between the two of them. And it doesn't change who I am, it doesn't change what I'm saying, it just changes how people look at me and kind of form a snap judgment just based on a stupid little physical thing that has no bearing on who I am.
Yeah, and I guess that's one of the ways Second Life lets you out of it. I mean, for sure walking around as a pregnant woman is wholly different than walking around as a non-pregnant woman. There's all those things.
What? Tell me this story with this thing in the nose.
I have the middle of my nose. It's a septum piercing, and just like, I mean, it's easy to hide. You can just throw it up, and nobody, at least mine, because a lot of people wear like rings in it. But I mean, if I walk into an interview with it out, immediately the interview would not be favorable, and the person would just form a snap judgment based on that, even though it's stupid. Even like when I go out to bars, if
suppose you're going into an interview where you knew that you didn't have much of a chance.
Oh, I will go with it out at some point in this interview season. But I mean, the best example would be...
No, stop.
Okay.
Here I am. Okay. You walk into me, you look just like you look now. You give me just the same story you've given all the rest of the places that are better than us, worse than us, and have turned you down.
Okay.
Now you come to interview with us. Would you rather come in with the thing in your nose or the thing not?
I'd rather come into all my interviews with it out, because I got it done for a reason. But like, and this isn't an interview situation, because I honestly never tried going to an interview with it.
But it does say something about you, doesn't it? That you would come into the interview with a ring in your nose.
It does.
And what does it say?
What do I hope it would say, or what do I think most people take it to say?
Let's have it both ways.
What I think most people would take it to say is that I'm being disrespectful. And that's what almost everybody who I've asked who's been in a situation where they at some point were an interviewer has said it would be disrespectful for me to show up like that. And what I would want it to say is just that's how he wants to look. It has nothing to do with I mean, maybe it has something to do with my personality, I don't know, but I honestly just see it as like the same reason some people put makeup on in the morning, because they think they, you know, look better with it, or because they feel more comfortable that way. Like, I've got it done because I feel more comfortable with myself like that way.
The OCI interviews, they seem to me to be some of the most constrained things ever. I don't know if it's still the same as when I was a law student, but they cared what color stockings you were wearing. Like, I couldn't wear pants to an interview, that was completely out. You had to have the right height of heels on your shoes, and number of buttons on your jacket. They really had a whole program for you, and if it's that well programmed, then anything you do that steps out of the program does send a message, because the people on both sides of that interaction know that you know what you were supposed to look like when you walked into that room.
Yeah, I would not go to an interview showing my tattoos.
What tattoos are those?
I've got one on my arm here.
Ah.
Be quite an outfit to go to.
Yeah, that was a sorry thing. Where else
do you have
tattoos?
Nice, yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess to me that, and I understand that, but then to me it's like, then isn't the onus on you to choose a place that would accept you? I mean, like, at the end of the day, if you're changing your appearance, and I would do the same thing, I would cover my tattoos if I had tattoos. But at the end of the day, like, that's the culture of corporate America and these law firms. So you kind of accept it or not. And if you don't, I mean, you can find a different way. I mean, I guess I can understand the point, which is that, you know, it shouldn't matter. My appearance shouldn't matter. What should matter is how good my work is. And I totally sympathize with that. But at the end of the day, I mean, I feel like then part of it is on you to find a place that would accept you as you are. And if you, and like, so I can't, I mean, I think that's a tough thing. And I guess the second point I want to talk about was going back to the sort of conversation about real world versus Second Life. One of the things that I think is sort of unique and why Second Life is a little different is that the reset button can be pushed so easily, it seems. And I don't know Second Life, I don't have, but it seems like, you know, what's the worst case that happens if you piss a bunch of people off in Second Life? Like, I sign up with a new email address and create a new avatar. I can't do that in real life. I can't change the way I look. I can't get a set of friends the same way I can there. And so, I don't know, I haven't done Second Life, so I don't know if that's something that you guys who have done have seen, but I'd be interested to hear.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I took on my name, my avatar is Eon Berkman. And it carries my legend. I mean, I don't want to screw this thing up. It's like, no, I take on a new avatar, what do? Just the other one dies? It's like, you invest yourself in these things. This is your identity. This is your character. Yes?
Well, two things. One, I'm not sure if I see the difference with OCI in any other situation where you're expected to look a certain way. I mean, there must be a reason why you had the nose ring, which might be to like fit in with a certain culture. And maybe with them, if you showed up wearing a suit, they would also like kind of pass a snap judgment on you in the same way. That seemed, and also in terms of like the internet, I think the problem is that you can lie so well typing, and nobody would know. Like, that's why people would go undercover and pretend to be, you know, like FBI agents pretend to be like moms with like 11-year-olds, and they, you know, catch child predators or whatever. It's just so easy to, you know, just type out, you know, this is who I am, about me. Like, I'm, you know, a 48-year-old man, 5'10", like, you know, just, and it's, I think that it's more easy to manipulate your identity when you're typing without, like, I guess, the appearance. And that's why people use those cues, like when you look a certain way to like say things about you.
Yeah, but I got a hypothetical on the table here.
Okay.
It's a poker question. He's thinking about how he's going to do this interview. On the one hand, he's thinking, I'm going to go in just the way I went into all the rest of those where I didn't make it. And on the other, he's thinking through, well, how could I play this if I put the ring in my nose? And he knows, right off the bat, the first reaction is going to be disrespect. This guy's disrespecting me. But can we think of any approach that would disarm that? You almost, in poker terms, he makes a move. Instead of coming in with a neutral mask that gives away as little as possible, he comes in with something that expresses a striking message out of the ordinary. Definitely has the guy's attention or the woman's attention. And yes, he can peg the reaction. It's going to be one of disrespect. But he's got an argument underneath it that's actually got enough power to move him. Yeah.
But, I mean, in poker terms, I mean, you're almost asking the wrong question, right? It's not just like, okay, like, should he come in with the nose ring out or not? Because, okay, if the nose ring comes out, it's respect. The question is, what does the nose ring mean to him? Because in poker terms, it's almost never advantageous to expose your true intent or your true strength or, like, your true self in this case, unless that's not who you really are. So if he realizes that, like, so unless he's intending to give a misleading impression, there would be almost zero advantage in exposing the nose ring.
All right. This is too difficult a problem for just the hiring committee to handle. So I've brought this issue before the whole firm. We're going to have a short partnership discussion and a vote on whether we should hire this kid that walked in. And
my grades aren't high enough for them to actually do this. So that's another thing against me.
His grades are slightly below. From what I can tell, he spent a lot of time in law school playing poker. But as far as I can tell also, this kid's a player. He understands the use of a mask, and he could explain it to you like nobody's business. He came into my office and just took it over without me even knowing. Instantly in control of the space. And he handled that control with total grace from beginning to end, to a point where I felt he educated me.
We missed the part where that happened. What does one say to the interviewer? Aren't you just distracting from the actual subject of the interviews?
What is the actual subject of the interview? What am I looking for when I interview somebody coming in to see me?
For 20 minutes.
I'm
the interviewer. What am I looking for? I'm the baseball scout. I'm the one who's out there looking for talent.
You're looking for three types of people: the rainmakers, the workhorses, and the legal geniuses.
Well, all right, that's a step ahead right there. Now you're at least thinking in terms of their categories.
I think you might just be looking for the workhorses.
Yeah. That's the impression I got.
At this level of hiring, you don't have any chance to be a rainmaker or a legal genius.
See, I also got the impression during OCI that OCI does a brilliant job of sorting, like, exactly what it's like to be in a big firm. Like, they give you a constrained period of time. They give you the exact rules of how they want you to, when they want you to show up, how they want you to look, what they want you to do, what they want you to bring with you. And, like, be here at your time, be here for your time, and then go home. And then when I went in the summer to the firm, I got the impression that for most of the young associates, it was like, keep your head down, look a certain way, work hard, turn in good work, and, like, make your way up the ladder. Like, I got the impression that OCI, for the most part, would not be friendly to somebody coming in with a nose ring, because a nose ring says something about your personality that would not be friendly to the corporate environment that they built. They're looking for workhorses. They need people to plug in 2,200 hours a year so that they can bill you out at $305 an hour and make their bottom line. And that was the impression I got. That was the impression I got in summary.
It's true. Just look at the quality of the art that they put in the walls in those places. It says, like, what sort of aesthetic they're looking for. Unobtrusive, inoffensive.
That's the danger to me of avatars generally. I mean, because if you put something forward that's not you, and you end up getting something based on that thing, whatever it is, then you're kind of stuck in that place that you got because you were being inauthentic. So, I don't know. I still think that you can demonstrate an ability to be a workhorse or to know the law, even if you have a nose ring. It's a matter of whether or not, like, the things that you're demonstrating when you're in the interview are really about you. Like, I like to work hard. I like research. Focus on the aspects of the job that are important to the person and kind of get away from the nose ring.
See, that's, like, the funny thing, because a bunch of my friends who got to know me at this school before I got the nose ring are the type of people who, Lella would not be generally friends with somebody who had a nose.
He wears a lot of mascara, though.
He wears no mascara. He just has very big eyes. But no, it's interesting because people who, when they meet me, don't see me with it in there. When I pull it out, kind of like, doesn't faze them. But for people who I just meet while I'm wearing it, instantly, like, it's one of the first things. You can tell within like 10 seconds of talking, they start looking, they start asking about it. And then I mean, most of the time, they don't end up being my friends. So it's interesting to see because, like you said, you want to put forward who you are as a person. And I feel that this is a very, very, very small and insignificant part of my personality. But from experience, I found that other people see it as a very, very significant part of my personality.
Why do you still wear it?
Because I like it.
But if it's so small and insignificant versus the cost of, because you're driving off people who obviously perceive it as being a large thing.
Because I don't think I should have to change for them. I have enough friends already.
Fair enough.
Who's not spoken? I want to hear from people who's not spoken. You spoke once. Go.
About what? I mean, I think it's just that, I guess that also about the nose ring is that the firm is not just like, you're not just, you're becoming an individual within the larger firm itself, and so you're becoming part of the firm's identity. So by having the nose ring out, you're, or something like that, they're also choosing to bring you in onto their identity itself. So you're going to reflect that. If you, I mean, depending on what people think of a nose ring, you'll, you know, that will be the reflection that, you know, prospective clients, other attorneys, judges, people like that will have at the firm. So, I mean, that also goes into the entire sort of calculus that they think about.
I'm just saying, I understand, like, when I got it done, I wasn't being an idiot, like, oh, nobody's going to care. Like, I understood I would be judged based on it. I just, I don't know, I guess a small part of me is kind of hoping that stuff will start to change and people will stop judging people based on snap judgments of how they look, you know.
Yeah.
I guess I'm kind of okay with snap judgments based on how people look, because I think that one of the great things about your image is that you can change it, that it's malleable, that one day I can decide to wear the clothes I wore in college and show my tattoos and be dressed as a hippie. I can go to a club and dress like a skank and have guys buy me a drink. Or I can dress like a professional. And I think there's a lot of power from embracing the fact that your image does have power, it does send a message, and to not be so attached to having one singular image. I think that, you know, you can wear them all.
I had an experience that was felt just like that over the weekend. I don't know if you know, but I basically gave up wearing any kind of clothes.
That's fine.
Other than turtleneck. That was it, turtleneck and khaki pants. That meant that when I got up in the morning, I didn't have to figure out what color necktie, didn't have to find the collar stays, and I didn't have to send things out to the cleaners. You can just wash it. I mean, there were so many good reasons. And over the weekend, I went to the Civil Rights Division thing. And I don't know why, but I purposely wore a white shirt with the collar stays and the necktie that came from your wedding. And that felt completely different to me, being in that dress. And somehow it was like being in camouflage. I felt like, all right, nobody's relating to me in a way, I don't know, it just was different. It felt for me like a mask, like a neutral, but comforting in some way. It was like, it was less exposed. So it is curious to hear you describe this process. It's really ugly. I mean, whoa. Conformist routine that has you wearing uniforms and speaking in certain ways and hiding your own identity in these neutralized, neutered, corporate, institutionalized council masks, which apparently the view is the firms demand and judge you on, and the more automaton you are, the more they want you. And I guess the more automaton you are, the more they keep you. Is that the idea? I mean, and ultimately they promote you to partner as the number one, the best automaton we ever had? And is that partner material?
But they pay you a lot. So then you can, I don't know, when you're like really old and retire, then you can be yourself with all your money.
Yeah, is that really true, like partners on automatons? I don't think it's true.
No, I mean, geez, on the other side of it, the partners are a bunch of entrepreneurs. They're the ones that make the gun go. It's like, they're the ones that are, and if there are some partners that somehow we admitted into the partnership on a misapprehension and we wind up carrying, we'll get the fuck rid of them. Because this is a business like just about any other. And that's the way a lot of the partnerships work.
It's built as a pyramid doesn't mean that the people who are at the top of it are the same ones as the people who come in at the bottom of the funnel. I mean, it's quite a shuffling, changing process. And somewhere in there, the rainmakers and the legal geniuses who, you know, maybe they did their workhorse period or maybe they've been doing something else and they want to make a lot of money, they come and they be a partner. Do something else. They work in government for some years, and then they get invited to be a fancy partner without going through that same thing.
Yes, there are ways around. That's absolutely right.
I mean, most firms are like what, like three associates to one partner or something like that? Does that sound approximately right? If that's true, then somewhere along the line, two associates are going elsewhere, right?
Yeah.
More than that, because the lifespan of an associate is 7 to 10 years, and the lifespan of a partner could be up to 35 or something.
Sure.
Yeah. Doug?
I just think it seems like we're talking about all the kind of different structures that people conform to in, like, in, say, a law firm or in society in general. And so there's actually a massive opportunity to be non-conformist. It's much more easy to set yourself out. You can just have a tiny thing like a notary, and suddenly you're completely different. Whereas something like Second Life doesn't necessarily have those structures, especially when you make your round for the first time. You don't know what the structures are. You could be non-conformist with. And so we know now, like you said, that lots of women look like they had to be strippers or men look like they're huge, you know, muscle. But it's very hard to be non-conformist with something like Second Life. So you lose some of the power of that. And so some people in society make a lot of play out to be able to be non-conformist, which actually has a lot of benefits to society. So the way things work, you have the non-conformist and the conformist. So I wonder whether Second Life loses anything or gains anything by not having that.
That's very interesting.
I don't play poker. I do a lot of political stuff at Harvard, and it's kind of gruesome the way that we play politics at the undergraduate level. But I remember this instance when I really wanted to be put on this committee, and I needed to go through the selection process. And one of the people who was on this committee that was to elect me to this other committee, I needed her vote, but she really hated me. I knew she hated me. So I had to sit down with her.
She hated you?
Oh, she hated me.
Why did she hate you?
Because I'd screwed over on something else before. So I'd find some way of getting her on board. And so I sat down with her and I was like, hey, you know, I know we haven't got along in the past, but I think I should nominate you for this job. And I gave her a list of reasons which really applied to me as to why I thought that she would be a perfect fit for the other thing. And then it turned out that she was like my most ardent defender on this when the election actually came around in this committee vote, because she figured, you know, she didn't actually want the job, but she figured that all the reasons that, you know, I described her as a perfect fit were actually a great fit for me. It's what I wanted in the first place. And so she had all these reasons going in to put me on this committee because she wanted those things to be true about her. So my point being this, that I found that in political negotiations, everyone sort of comes in with an agenda. They want information from you. And the sooner you get that problem out of the way, the sooner you tell them what they want to know, the sooner that they can get around to telling you what you want to know. And if I wouldn't choose, you know, being hated by this girl, you know, to begin with, it was a handicap any more than I would choose to, you know, wear a nose ring into an important interview, as it sounds like it would be a handicap. But if I had that situation, and if I really wanted to wear this ring, and I was going to wear it no matter what, and I was walking into this interview, I would take 5 minutes out of my 20 minutes and to talk about why I was wearing the nose ring. Because if I didn't, I would know that for the entire 20 minutes, that's all they would be thinking about. And I don't know if it would be better or not. I don't know how the situation would end up. That's how I would approach it.
There are high-level business consulting firms that work exactly on the principle that any company that has a problem, there is what they call an elephant in the room. There's something that they're not talking about. And it's the thing that they're not talking about that you somehow have to get out on the table. Yeah. So that's very interesting. I found it a fascinating story. Twice fascinating. I mean, fascinating. I mean, this idea of telling them what they want to know, because that's the sooner to get to the point where they'll tell you what you want to know. That's very interesting as a thought. And then this manipulative meeting that you had with this young woman struck cold into my heart. I mean, are you really that manipulative that you sat down and objectified her to that point? How could you be so heartless?
Well, only because I knew she didn't want it. If I thought that she was going to go for it, I wouldn't have told her all those lovely reasons that she should.
Sounds like a corroboration of the heartlessness.
I didn't tell her anything that was untrue.
But here you tell us this story. This is the kind of poker player you are. We really got to watch you. We never know now, from now on, whether what we're getting from you is straight or whether you've got some agenda.
Everyone has an agenda.
But according to his thesis, if we know that he has an agenda, the quicker we can get it from him and get our own agenda out there. So maybe now we're a step up.
Yes.
In some ways, it seems like all this whole conversation just based on the notion that it all comes down to having imperfect information, right? Because the reason law firms have these notions of what you should wear in an interview, and they base the things on grades or where you went to law school, is because they don't have information on you. So they have to use whatever proxies are the best that can mitigate their sort of risk in hiring you. And you know, is it perfect? No. I mean, I'm sure they slip a lot of times and lose a lot of good people. But are the sort of false positives greater than the false negatives? I mean, that's a question I would ask myself as a partner when I'm hiring people and making decisions. Like, I mean, it's perfectly reasonable to say, well, this guy with the nose ring seemed like a really smart guy. I think he's great, and like we should hire him. But then, you know, if you go to the other partner and they say, well, you know, if we believe, for some reason, we think that signals one thing or the other, maybe it's like more inclination to rebel against the conformist notions that are equipment, right? That maybe if that's true, then we think of it in some way. So I mean, I think it all comes, if they have perfect information about you, it wouldn't matter whether you wear a nose ring or not, right? Like,
what do you say during the 20-minute interview? Whatever it is, OCCI tell you that too?
More or less.
Yes.
More or less they tell you what
really?
To say?
Yeah. I skipped all those seminars.
They tell you because at some point during the interviewer is going to ask, do you have any questions about the firm? And there's not a single question that you actually want answered from them that you're allowed to ask at the interview.
Uh-huh.
But also, I mean, so I worked at a consulting firm for a couple of years before law school, and so I've seen sort of the other side of the process, the hiring process. And like, the people can see through these questions pretty easily. People can see through what, I wouldn't go by what OCS says to do, because I think a lot of times they're just off. And like, I think people, at the end of the day, it's a conversation between two people, right? It's the same way you'd have a conversation with someone. I mean, it's a little different because you're trying to get hired. So, I mean, yeah, there's that element too. But at the end of the day, I mean, people are, I mean, they're looking to find workhorses, fine, but they're also looking to find people they want to work with. People that if you're stuck at an airport with for 5 hours, like, you'd be okay with. And I think that that still has an element to it as well. And so, I mean, I don't know. I feel like a lot, I'm saying this because I think the OCS advice a lot of times is kind of the wrong advice.
Yeah,
Don't you think it's harder for them to figure out if they want to work with you if you've come in there in the most absolutely cookie cutter
right, and I think that possible? People read through that very easily. I mean, these are smart people. They're not going to, you come in and say like, oh, I really want to, you know, really fascinated about document with you or whatever. And like, yeah, no, you're not.
I always hoped that it was a woman interviewing me, because then you can like, you can sort of get the positive feelings that you need just by being a little flirty.
Great. Works for some of us better than others.
Can I happen to know a great sexual harassment lawyer?
She's senior to me.
She's a plaintiff's lawyer.
Work in the reverse.
Yeah. No, it actually does. Yeah. I don't know. I just know from personal experience and from a lot of my friends that if you're a guy and you flirt a little bit with an elderly female interviewer.
Well, flirting with anyone is always helpful. I mean,
it doesn't work as well for us when we flirt with the elderly male interviewer. Oftentimes they find that interesting. I'm not.
Of course,
I've seen, I've tried it.
Woods, are you like flirting with male skills that well developed?
I was a cheerleader for 3 years.
Touche. What do you think the interviewer is actually looking for? There I am. I've done this job. You take a train or a plane, and you schlep to some place, and you stay in a hotel, and you get up in the morning, you take a taxi cab to a little office, and you got a schedule that's got people on it at 20-minute intervals with one little bathroom break and then a short lunch break, and you go right through till dinner, and then you have to take a whole bunch of them out to dinner afterwards. It's like, this is the duty we inflict on people who really love the firm or people who don't have the power to say no.
Right. Well, kind of. I mean, it's still probably less work than your regular associate work day at the law firm.
Yep, it's possible to look at it that way. There I am. I've got a day off. I'm going up to Harvard. I'm getting a chance to talk to a whole bunch of kids. Could be interesting.
See, I'm interviewing in San Diego, so they have to fly from California to Massachusetts, so they're not happy.
Yeah, well, that's what you're up against.
I think what they do is they look through these resumes. They have an idea of which people are in the right grades and other categories for them, and then they go to the interviews and they're just looking to cross people off who act weird.
I mean, they're the masters of the filter. What they're looking through to get through the other end is the totally homogenized product.
Not necessarily homogenous, but I mean, they come in and these are really impressive people they're interviewing. Everybody here is completely capable of doing the jobs that all of these firms have to offer. And the people who are doing the interviews, I think, are totally aware of that. This question of this, you know, risk of hiring, I think it's fairly low. I mean, the risk is, are you going to pick somebody who's going to say no to your offer because they've got a better offer, more than are you going to pick somebody who's not actually going to be able to do the associate work when you get them?
Yeah, I think that's probably true in most cases, but when it fails, it can be spectacularly bad, and that's the big risk. So, like, for example, we had a guy who, you know, got an offer, and, you know, it was the kind of situation where, like, people thought there was something off about him from the beginning, and some of that was probably appearance-based. They gave him an offer anyway. He ended up being a disaster. I mean, to the point where he disclosed confidential info to the Wall Street Journal, lost the biggest client of the firm. I mean, like, one associate, one kid out of undergrad, this is the kind of damage you can do to the firm. So there is a big risk. And yeah, I mean,
that's what I mean, the crossing off the people who seem off when you interview them.
Right, but there's also, I mean, I think, and I guess it depends on how many people you're hiring, but I think there's also like a fit element. Like, do you fit with the culture? I mean, I don't know. I think legal hiring might be a little different than what I'm sort of consulting hiring, but I mean, like, a lot of times you've got more candidates that are qualified than spots you have to give, and so you've got to find some way, and I think a lot of times it's just, do you think this person would be, like, did you have a good conversation with the person? I mean, I think that goes into it. I don't know if that's true more broadly, but I know that that's sort of what I was on.
There's a little more reason why you should wear your nose ring, if that's what, it, you know, if that's what your thing is, if that's your memorable thing, because you are competent and you'll be great at like doing the law. So if you can stand out in somebody's memory, whether they won't remember, maybe they'll remember it's a nose ring, but maybe they'll just remember it was a good conversation and kind of comfortable with it because you weren't not having your nose ring.
Does the office coach you on any strategies going in?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, could they give you an opening move?
They tell you what to say.
Yeah?
They, literally everybody asks, because like I also, this one's kind of not as obvious, but they're like, I talked with she worked as the legal recruiting coordinator for, I forget which firm, but then she moved to Goldsmith Meyer Africa, what's the name of it?
Is it? Major ones.
Yeah, that one. And they're like, their whole point is to find, like, headhunting for legal jobs. And she was like, if you're working in San Diego, that'll be fine, but don't wear that to an interview.
Uh-huh.
And I could go in and say the exact same thing with it in or with it out, and I have a feeling that I would come across completely differently.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't it ultimately come down to like resource allocation? Like it would seem to me like in any of these things, it's like risk allocation, right? Mm-hmm. Or like risk assessment. So if it was me, I would push the nose ring up, do 5 or 6 interviews, put a couple in the bag, and then pull the nose ring down and see if you can find a firm that'll take you with the nose ring.
But, see, I kind of already did, but the partner was drunk when he told me that, so.
That's a different strategy.
Okay.
So it's a little like finding a reset button, doing all these interviews. It replicates that. It's a very different way to think about things when you do have that reset button concept.
It's
what
true.
We're doing in class this evening, in my class, we're also talking about identity, but we have some different stories that we're working from. One of them is about this rape that takes place in this virtual world in which one guy is basically able to program a bot that causes other avatars to do actions against their will. And so he publicly stages them having sexual interactions with people that they don't want to have in front of a lot of people. And then ultimately this causes a major disruption in the society, and there's a question about what the punishment should be and whether one treats this as something that's more similar to an actual rape or more similar to a sort of a nasty speech act, because obviously no physical harm is done. But we're really into this space of the difference between virtual action and actual action and speech, three really different categories. Ultimately, they kill the avatar as punishment for this. The avatar is just removed from the society, although he comes back under a new persona not that long afterwards, but with mitigated behavior. But it really poses this question of what the difference is between the identity that you can get away from and the identity that you're stuck with in your real life.
That's beautiful, man. Are you doing that tonight?
Yeah.
Is that online?
It'll all be webcast, yeah.
Want to pass out a URL? Or?
If anybody wants to come, they're welcome. I don't know if it's linked from our course website or what. Anyway, the way to come is to come to Berkman Island at Second Life, and it'll be webcast there in the amphitheater at 7:35.
Huh.
We're talking about that in another story of a mysterious death of a Norwegian beauty queen who participated in one of these worlds.
These things sound fascinating.
They're very fun stories.
Well, all right. Tomorrow, I've invited a WGBH freelance documentary television producer to come to class. And I'm wanting to talk with you about the production side of things. And our first opportunity to put anything into play as kind of a, well, first try, is October 8th, where we're having some guests talk about the principle of law, the idea of government under law as opposed to government under men, which is like the classic ideal that's up on the top of Langdell. And prosecutorial abuse of it in the form of abuse of the threat of indictment and the extortion of guilty pleas with the threat of indictment. And so I'd love you to be thinking a little bit about who might be audience, that is, who might we like to have present for that in addition to ourselves. And I should have said that tomorrow I have a date with the producer to meet with our audiovisual department. And the idea here is that universities have tremendous resources, but very seldom are they used in a way that approaches any professional quality. And so the idea of bringing in a professional who can actually articulate what the different roles are and oversee what the actually wonderful equipment is that the university can provide to do an occasion that is of our making, that's the idea. So what I'm expecting to do tomorrow is talk about the different roles that are involved in production and actually have you thinking about the possibility of you filling it. Because I would like very much to have this be as much as possible an expression of the idea that the means are in our hands, that it's possible to produce very high quality material for the net at almost no cost to the university, additional cost to the university at all. So, okay, that's where we are. Thank you very much, Rebecca. Thank you very much, Ken.
Anytime.
Anytime, yes. Anytime.
If anybody's still working on getting into Second Life and you want to do it, you can feel free to check out the first assignment that the students in my class did, which is basically a step-by-step walkthrough of how to get started in Second Life.